The following program is for blind and print-impaired listeners, and it is from the North Carolina Reading Service. And it features me, John Federson, reading the weekly issue of Indie Week. This reading is from the issue dated October the 5th, 2023. And our musicians creep away, and they allow me to get started with today's issue. There are three articles in this week's issue concerning labor unions and various labor union actions, and the first takes place at Durham Waffle House. Dozens of workers staged a demonstration last Friday at Durham Waffle House rallying for fair wages. Workplace safety and an end to unfair paycheck deductions as part of a months-long initiative that aims to improve working conditions for employees of the restaurant chain's nearly 2,000 locations. This demonstration took place on NC Highway 55 and was arranged and primarily attended by members of the Union of Southern Service Workers, USSW, who flooded the restaurant during breakfast hours and delivered speeches over a backdrop of clattering kitchenware. Vivian Wilson, a USSW member who has worked at the Waffle House in Asheville for the past 2 years, recalled instances in which customers threatened her or requested that she take off her clothes. "When I told my manager I was scared to work," she said, "she told me she's been threatened many times, which made me feel like I was just overreacting." After Wilson spoke, the group moved the demonstration inside, chanting and waving signs at cars and passersby. One on the clock Waffle House worker, Taj Mahal Smith, walked out with them in a spontaneous strike. An advocacy group that evolved from the southern branch of Fight for $15, the USSW has centered its efforts around organizing Waffle House locations since July, when workers at a house in Columbia, South Carolina, went on strike. According to a release, the strike came after management refused to meet workers' demands for increased security at the Columbia location, which, like all Waffle Houses, is open 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, in the wake of a series of distressing interactions with customers. One, for instance, had retrieved his gun from his truck after being served grits instead of hash browns. In mid-September, more Waffle House workers staged rallies at locations in Orangeburg, South Carolina, and Atlanta, Georgia, and last week, the USSW released a petition enumerating three company-wide demands. The first demand, labeled Safety at Work, asked that Waffle House management not only hire round-the-clock security, but also allow workers to have a, quote, real input on creating a safety plan for their store, including during natural disasters. The chain, as anyone familiar with the Waffle House Index knows, is famous for remaining open during extreme weather. Other demands include an end to Waffle House's mandatory meal deduction policy, which requires workers to purchase discounted shift meals, and a $25 an hour wage for all employees. Wilson said at the demonstration in Durham, "Some days I feel like I'm a maid, waitress, busser, and dishwasher for only $2.13 an hour plus tips. My paycheck is barely $100 a week. If I made $25 an hour, I'd be able to get a car," she said, "and take my cat to the vet." And we move right ahead for another Durham article. Following union organizing and a strike, Durham's lowest paid workers are on the brink of a major victory, writes Justin Laidlaw. On a warm September evening, this is a dateline October the 4th, dozens of city workers, donning their blue uniforms and yellow safety vests, gathered outside Durham City Hall, residents carrying signs that said, "Fair pay, and our workers deserve a living wage," filled the plaza in anticipation After brief remarks, a group of sanitation workers were ushered in to the front of the crowd, and a man introduced himself, grinning from ear to ear. He said, "My name is James Davis, a.k.a. the number one can slinger." But his tone quickly switched from jovial to impassioned. He was fired up, standing shoulder to shoulder with his fellow solid waste management department employees, who were demanding immediate $5,000 bonuses and salary increases for city workers in next year's budget. Davis shouted through the PA system, "During COVID, everybody you see up here worked every day. While the people that sat behind that podium was at home on their computers shooting out emails, we was in here at 5 o'clock shooting our head with the laser, checking our temperature, putting those masks on our face, gloves on, sticking us on the truck by ourselves because they said they don't want us riding with nobody else. People don't see that." Davis, a Durham native, worked for a private maintenance company doing HVAC, electrical and carpentry work prior to taking a job with the city. He has worked for Durham for 14 years and currently employed as a maintenance technician in the solid waste department. He says, "It actually took me about 4 or 5 years to get on with the city. Every year I kept getting little letters coming back saying I was overqualified. I never did understand that. How can you be overqualified to dump a trash can?" On September 5, solid waste employees delivered their demands to the city council. Feeling their concerns were not adequately addressed, workers walked off the job the next day. Elected officials, in the heat of a contentious election season, expressed sympathy with the workers, and in mid-September, City Manager Wanda Page brought forth a proposal that gave bonuses to all city employees. The council deferred the original proposal, requesting that Page's staff allocate more money to lower-salaried workers. This weekend, Page returned with a counteroffer that will likely result in one-time bonus payments of $5,000 to the city's lowest-paid workers and $3,500 to those who make less than $70,000 annually. Additionally, an upcoming pay study will likely recommend salary increases for all city workers for the next fiscal year, in what the Public Employees Union is calling a major win. The council is poised to approve the bonus payments this month. The discussion about city workers' wages reached a boiling point last June when the city passed its 23-4 fiscal year budget. At the beginning of the meeting, city firefighters and police officers made a last-minute bid for pay raises, in addition to the 7% salary increase and $300 bonus for all sworn employees already in the budget. Mayor Elaine O'Neill, with support of Councillors Tidiana Freeman and Monique Holsey-Hyman, motioned for a vote to grant the first responders' request, a move that caught her remaining colleagues off guard. Councilman Mark Anthony Middleton said during the meeting, "We had no advance notice of this. I'm hard-pressed to see this as anything other than posturing on behalf of our colleagues since this matter is already on the agenda." The mayor's motion set off a raucous discussion about the budget that lasted over 2 hours. The council eventually voted 4-3 in favor of passing that budget, with no additional pay for workers. The first responders' demands did not come out of nowhere. During the height of the pandemic, pay increases for all city workers were suspended due to financial uncertainty, and the first responders had been vocal during the budget negotiating period for the 23-24 fiscal year. But it's not as clear why, suddenly, at the September 5 council meeting, sanitation workers, who had far less representation during the budgeting cycle compared to their public safety colleagues, brought demands for higher salaries and bonuses before the council. With no immediate action from the council on these demands, employees from the city's solid waste department went on strike for 5 days. UE Local 150, a union that represents public workers and has chapters across the state, with the goals of securing better wages and working conditions and protection from unfair treatment, helped organize the workers and guide them in their negotiations with the city. UE Local 150 aims to eventually establish collective bargaining rights for public employees in North Carolina. Dante Strubino, an international representative for UE, when workers delivered their petition at the meeting, they were hoping for there to be some concrete movement to implement that. Instead, they just got supportive political platitudes and nothing concrete. That night after the council meeting, frustrated, and seeing this dragging on endlessly, they decided to take some determined action. North Carolina General Statute 9598.1 prohibits public employees from striking, making that worker strike an illegal one. The statute applies to employees at any level of government within North Carolina. While council members say their understanding of the workers' plight, many of them have said their hands are tied when it comes to raising salaries off budget and are wary of actions the state may take against them if they're seen as being too sympathetic toward the striking workers. Middleton quotes, "Somebody in state government sent us an email and sent us the statute that talks about what you're supposed to do when you engage in collective bargaining. It talked about what happens to employees who engage in the strike. I invite you to Google that." So they are watching what we're doing here. They're watching Durham. Engaging in a strike is a Class 1 misdemeanor in North Carolina, and employees who walk off the job are not legally protected. They could be fired on the spot. And while city officials did not take such drastic action in response, they're still at the mercy of state law. Instead of terminating workers during that work stoppage, the city hired contractors from Waste Industries, a subsidiary of GFL Environmental, to collect city residents' trash and recycling. That's not an uncommon practice for cities like Durham, according to city attorney Kimberly Rayberg. Cities provide public services in a range of methods, she said. Some cities have people fully employed in-house to provide a wide array of services. Some of them use private contractors to handle many of their governmental activities and functions. Rayberg adds that certain jobs that fall under the city's purview may require specific skills that its workers don't have, or the volume of work may be too high for just city staff to manage. Citywide emergencies like the storm that ripped through the Triangle in August are situations where the city might contract out additional support. Rayberg continued, a lot of it tends to be based on the size of the municipality. A city the size of Durham, Raleigh, Greensboro, or Charlotte is going to have a lot more capacity, but also a much larger population to service. Given the scale, it's going to make more sense to have employees employed by the city. Still, even the largest cities routinely use private contractors for specialized activities and exceptional service needs. Still, the move angered the sanitation employees, who felt the money spent on contractors could have been put toward the workers' demands. But Middleton said the council has a responsibility to the city's residents. He said, when the strike started and garbage was on the street, the government has no choice, because it is now an emergency situation, to do whatever it has to do to make sure disease is not spread through the city, to make sure the garbage gets picked up. At the direction of council, City Manager Page proposed one-time bonuses for all employees across four salary tiers. Salaries less than $57,000 would receive $3,000 bonuses. Between $57,000 and $90,000 would receive $2,500 bonus. Salaries more than $90,000 receive $2,000 bonus, and part-time employees receive $1,000. These would be administered from the city's fund balance. Durham's general fund, which provides funding for core city services, is $281 million for 23-4 fiscal year. The city is required to have at least 16.7% in its fund balance. That's, in effect, the city's savings to operate in case of emergency. According to city staff, Durham operates at about 25% savings. A total fund balance is not set until after the previous year's budget is already adopted. additional revenues come in that the city can't fully account for prior to the budget deadline in June. So that money is added to the fund balance. From there, the city manager and staff can make recommendations for how to allocate the extra funding that is left after meeting the 25% threshold. Those extra funds can only be used for one-time expenditures. In previous years, the city purchased things like new trucks and other equipment upgrades. Christina Reardon, the interim director of Budget and Maintenance Service, explained at the September 21 council work session that the money for the bonuses would come out of the city's reserve funds, and accordingly, why the city cannot raise salaries outside the last budget cycle, saying, "Fund balance and reserve maintenance are important because they provide financial safety nets in the event of emergencies, economic downturns, or other unforeseen circumstances. Fund balance and reserve maintenance are also major factors considered by bond rating agencies when evaluating the city's creditworthiness." But the council did not approve the proposed bonus, and at the end of the work session, members directed Page and her staff to rework the structure so that employees at the lower end of the pay scale would receive more in bonuses, and those at the higher end would receive less. This weekend, Page returned with three options on which the council will vote this month. The updated proposal offers one-time bonuses to employees based on Durham's Area Medium Income, the AMI. All three options include $5,000 bonuses for employees making under 60% of the AMI, which is calculated to be roughly $42,000 for one person. The workers' other demand, an increase in annual compensation, will have to wait until after the city conducts its pay study and proposes market-based salary adjustments for the next fiscal year. City staff conduct market studies on a regular basis to assess whether the city offers competitive employee compensation packages, and that pay study is scheduled to begin this month. It will take months to complete that study, and any raises likely won't be approved until the new budget is adopted next summer. And while city employees are likely to get their bonuses in November, it's time they say they don't have. The cost of living has increased exponentially, workers say, and many say they can't afford to live in the city limits. Solid waste employee John Burwell says just about everyone lives abroad. Very few live in Durham. Different places. They're spread out. You can barely afford Durham. It's outrageous. The property tax rate in Durham is 55.7 cents per $100 of assessed value, meaning that a house valued the median in Durham of $245,000 would generate a tax bill of about $1,400, according to the Durham County website. Outgoing city council member Jillian Johnson says once that pay study wraps, it's probably a good time for the city to consider raising taxes. She said during the budget meeting back in June, taxes are really low in this community. Property tax hits lower income residents harder than higher, so raising the property tax in a housing crisis is a really difficult decision and really hard to sell to a community that's already struggling. While raising taxes is a hard sell, as Johnson said, the results of the pay study will likely indicate a need to also raise salaries. And in order to provide those increases, the next city council could be looking at having to increase property tax rates, a decision that could prove to be politically unpopular. Still, some council members are trying to leverage the workers' strike and demands for salary increases into a campaign issue. Holsey Hyman said during a city work session, "Let's stop playing for who's for it and who's not for it. Everybody has seen who is for it. It's really hard, especially what I've been through, to sit here and say, oh yes, we care about you. Oh yes, we support you. But then you're not moving in the direction you could have moved in a long time ago." Willie Brown, a public works employee and UE Local 150 member, worked with other city employees to host a candidate forum last week at Lyon Park, where workers could ask questions about issues that are important to them. Brown was a CDL truck driver for years before joining the city over a year ago. He and his wife settled in the Triangle to help raise their grandchildren. Brown remains concerned that life in Durham is becoming increasingly harder. As a disabled veteran, he says, my wife has to go to the VA department in Durham, so we tried our best to get a home here, but we're unable to afford a house. I live in Knightdale. I travel 45 minutes every day to work in Durham. I actually love it, but it's too far. At the candidate forum, workers shifted between cracking jokes with one another as they enjoyed a catered alpaca and listening intently to candidates as they made their cases for election. One by one, workers approached the stage to ask their questions to the group. George Bacot, a solid waste employee who moved to Durham from New Jersey in 2014, asked the panelists about their experience engaging with federal and state agencies, as these are the ones with the power to most directly impact workers' rights. Bacot moved to Durham after his sister relocated to the Triangle to pursue degrees at NC Central and UNC. He said this experience with the city has been stressful, but he's learned to hold people to their word and listen closely. He said he hadn't engaged with politics much before. Nobody in my community, neither. Nobody in the neighborhoods. I mean, we were always taught to vote Democrat. That's pretty much it. Now that he's seen how it impacts him more directly, he says he's excited to continue participating in the process. I am here for the long run. The crowd was mostly in good spirits, even as folks asked candidates tough questions. But James Davis sat in the back of the room with his arms crossed, unimpressed with the candidate's answers. He couldn't resist firing back after mayoral candidate Leonardo Williams finished responding to one of the prompts. Wasn't you against us? Blurted Davis, referring to the 4-3 vote in favor of passing the budget in June. On the brink of securing a major victory, workers like Burrell, Bacot, Brown and Davis have been clear that fair pay has been at the center of the ongoing tension between the city and its employees. But to those workers and their union counterparts, it's only part of the equation. There's also the question of what paying workers a fair wage represents. Dignity for those who do some of the city's least appealing, physically challenging and most dangerous but ultimately crucial jobs. It's a matter of respect. And Davis says money ain't everything. It'll help you live, but it ain't everything. Another online article is concerning unions for UNC housekeepers. We followed this story in the Indie Week for a good while. The decades-long fight for fair wages endures is the title of that, and it's a if I have a chance to read it, I will today. But there are too many other articles I need to go on, and nothing specific has been decided either for or against anything new info in the article. So UNC housekeepers is available, all these articles online for free at indieweek.com. But now I will move on to an article by Greg Childress. Cary Charter School illegally retaliated against math teacher, federal judge ruled. U.S. Department of Education's Office of Hearing and Appeals has ruled that Cardinal Charter Academy engaged in illegal retaliatory actions when it fired a math teacher who made protected disclosures, claiming that the school did not provide students with the special education service that their individual education plans required. Terry Schmitz's firing violated the National Defense Authorization Act, which addresses retaliation by a federal grant recipient for whistleblowing. Administrative Law Judge Robert Layton said in a decision and order address dated September 15th, Cardinal Charter's activities are covered under that act because it received more than $440,000 in Individuals with Disabilities Education Act money between 2020 and 2023 in pass-throughs from the NC Department of Public Instruction. Florida-based Charter Schools USA is a for-profit firm that manages more than 90 schools in five states, including Cardinal Charter and eight others in North Carolina, and Triangle Charter Education Association Board, one of several nonprofits with which Charters works to develop and outline the mission, vision, values, and policies of various schools, were the named grantees, in effect, the defendants in this proceeding. Layton ruled, complainant Schmitz has demonstrated her protected disclosures were contributing factors to Cardinal's decision to terminate her employment. The judge also ruled that Cardinal Charter failed to demonstrate that it would have fired Schmitz even if she had not disclosed inadequacies in the school's special ed programs. Schmitz informed school principal April Goff, Triangle Charter Education Associate Board President Alan Taylor, and Charter Schools USA Human Resources officials. Goff and Taylor had the responsibility to investigate, discover, and address reported conduct, misconduct under the NDAA. The ruling did not, however, award Schmitz monetary damages. At the time of her non-renewal in June of 22, Schmitz had a child attending the school who has speech and visual impairments. NC Newsline documented her concerns about the school's handling of special needs students in a report of August 2022. She had filed a complaint with the State Department of Public Instruction alleging her child and other similarly situated students attending the K-8 public charter school did not have a certified or licensed special ed teacher in the classroom during the first month of school. Cardinal Charter leaders acknowledged, quote, some special education services were missed due to staff shortages, and that the school provided inconsistent delivery of special ed services for all students with IEPs during the 21-22 school year. State investigators found Cardinal Charter violated state policies in five of the six issues it examined as a result of the complaint. The schools violated policies regarding teacher qualification, and it failed to properly implement the child's IEP, that's Individualized Public Education Plan. Investigators also concluded that the school failed to provide the child's teacher and Schmitz access to and copies of the child's IEP. They also violated policies that require periodic reports on a child's progress toward meeting annual goals outlined in that. Federal and state policies give little wiggle room when it comes to IEPs. The education plans ensure students with disabilities receive the specialized instruction and related services they require. Per state policy, IEPs must, quote, be implemented as written, beginning and throughout each school year. Schmitz complained about special ed services on three occasions between September 21 to June 22, without Cardinal Charter taking substantial steps to correct the issues. The court found these complaints were found to be valid. North Carolina ordered multiple corrective actions, which required significant expenditure for Cardinal to accomplish. These would reduce the annual profits of Cardinal's parent corporation. Then there's a section of this article talking about the actual whistleblower complaint. Summarizing, it just got to a point, she's saying, where something had to be done. The kids weren't getting services. In its initial ruling, the Office of Inspector General found that Schmitz had proven that a reasonable person would find that the disclosures were a contributing factor in the personnel action taken by Cardinal. The ruling threw Cardinal Charter a temporary lifeline, finding that Schmitz failed to substantiate her claim of whistleblower retaliation. She did not, the ruling concluded, prove that Cardinal Charter fired her because she made protected disclosures about these special ed programs. For its part, Cardinal's official said Schmitz's firing was due to budgetary constraints that stemmed from a projected decrease in enrollment. Schmitz appealed that ruling and was found by Judge Layton to have successfully refuted the claim by Cardinal. She provided documents showing 15 teachers, including herself, were not asked back for 22-23 school year, seven for budgetary reason. Four of the seven, including Schmitz, were among 11 teachers who signed a letter alerting school officials to their concerns about the quality of services provided special needs students. Among 40 teachers who did not sign the letter, only three were not rehired. Schmitz was told on June 10th that she would not be rehired due to budgetary concerns. Despite ruling that she was in fact improperly dismissed, Layton denied her request for $18,000 for 3 months' pay and attorney fees because she did not provide evidence that she suffered losses. He ruled that Schmitz would not have been paid over the 2 months she was out for the summer, even if she had been renewed. The fact she also began a new job at the beginning of the new school year, thereby mitigating any economic loss, also factored into Layton's decision. Her claims for $300,000 in damages for emotional distress and $300,000 in damages for loss of professional reputation were also denied. Colleagues at the school reportedly knew that Schmitz would be fired before it happened. Layton wrote, "In light of her commendable whistleblower activities, Schmitz's reputation is in all likelihood stellar. However, even if that were not the case, once again, in the absence of specific evidence and quantification, Schmitz cannot recover reputational damages. Instead, Layton awarded Schmitz nominal damages not to exceed $1. We'll change over, at least for a little bit, for a food-related article, this one about food truck owners in Durham. In this case, The Can Opener, 200 South Gregson Street. In a world of increasingly contrived reality TV show premises, even falling in love, one of the most dramatic things a person can do, seems to no longer provide enough basis for entertainment unless contestants are blindfolded, naked, or quarantined. There's something to be said about the lasting success of the Great Food Truck Race. Now in its 16th season, the Food Network show features competitors attempting to perform the day-to-day operations of a food truck owner. It's a premise that works without manufactured drama because food trucks involve grind. And as longtime Durham food trucker Joe Choi notes, mobile eateries come with a catch-22. Quote, "The beauty of food trucks is the freedom to go wherever you want. But on the other end of that, you're working under unpredictable conditions. Beyond your food, your location, and your aesthetics, you really don't have much control." His Korean barbecue food truck, Bulgogi, was launched in 2009. And that's part of the reason why he will soon be parking his truck for good. Well, one of his Bulgogi trucks. He has three. Two will remain mobile around town, but one is set to be permanently stationed at the Can Opener. That's a downtown Durham food truck park that Choi is launching this winter alongside his business partner, Bo Kwan. Ernest Harris, owner of the Knightdale-based barbecue food truck Chicken Q, and Gus Megaloudis of the Durham-based Greek street food truck Gussie's. An indoor-outdoor concept slated to open at the intersection of South Gregson and West Pettigrew Street, the Can Opener will include a semicircle of five food trucks, Bulgogi, Chicken Q, and Gussie's, with spots for two others that will change up day by day. as well as a bar harbored inside the old American Postal Workers Union building with coffee, wine, and 30 beers on tap. That space will seat around 350 people with indoor tables, a covered outdoor dining area near the trucks, and a rooftop patio. A line of trees buffered the site from nearby train tracks. Of course, in winter months, when branches are bare, rooftop diners will have a prime vantage point of the business's namesake. That is, of course, the Can Opener Bridge at Durham's Norfolk Southern Gregson Street overpass, nicknamed thusly for its tendency to rip the aluminum tops off of trucks that collide with its low overhead beam. The bridge, for example, has claimed the hoods of Choi's trucks on at least five occasions. For Choi, who has been a brick-and-mortar, who has a brick-and-mortar bulgogi location at Boxyard RTP, and also co-owns the Durham restaurant Namu, the can opener is sort of a culmination of his existing businesses. Namu, a sprawling restaurant off 15501, plays host to both a coffee bar and a beer hall. Boxyard RTP, nestled within the Research Triangle Park, contains a hodgepodge of food and beverage spots housed in shipping containers. Both concepts are echoed in the can opener, which is an unorthodox space with lots of moving parts. For Harris and Megalodis, the can opener marks a more significant shift. Harris, who has multiple chicken queue trucks but no brick-and-mortar location, will now be able to tell customers exactly when and where to find him. Megalodis, who has a brick-and-mortar Gussie's location but only one truck, will no longer be on wheels. After more than 10 years of showing up at gigs to find a site doesn't have hookups for power or water, Megalodis says, or that an event schedule has changed, he's ready to change mobility for stability. The three became friends in the early 2010s. Back then, Triangle's food truck community was smaller and more close-knit, which meant that if a disaster struck, owners wouldn't be on their own. Once, for instance, when a bulgogi's truck generator broke down, a nearby truck sawed off its generator and gave it to Choi. Now that food trucks are dime a dozen, the scene has become more competitive in the way the rest of the restaurant industry is, the owners say, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but in recent years has pushed them toward creating a communal space. The can opener will join the ranks of other Durham spots working to foster human connection after years of pandemic-induced isolation, like Boxyard, the Durham Food Hall, and Common Market. Now, the can opener is still under construction, so the owners are reluctant to specify a projected launch date, though they're aiming to open late this year. They envision the space as a breakfast and lunch spot for downtown employees. A breakfast food truck would be on site each day starting at 6:30 a.m., as well as a lively gathering place for families, a venue for weddings, live music, and other events. Harris envisions that the can opener will be, quote, a return to that quaint family-type feel, a return to that camaraderie. Now, before I get to a few articles concerning with music and the arts in Indie Week, here's an article I have not read since last April, actually, April 28th from Indie Week. And it's about the past, present, and future of UNC's Odom Village. It's a good enough article or important enough. I'll include it right now. Anna Neal of Indie staff writes, amongst the backdrop of UNC Medical Center, dozens of buildings sit empty. The two-story brick structures were once the primary graduate student and family housing at UNC Chapel Hill, Odom Village. Originally, Odom included 47 buildings on South Campus, but since their demolition commenced in 2016, 22 remain. The structures, surrounded by chain-link fences with overgrown grass, are the dormitories of the university's past, raising questions for passers-by. What's the history of Odom Village? What was it like when students lived there? And what's the future of this housing community? The university's high-rise style dorms of Eringhouse and Craig were constructed in 1962, but at the beginning of the decade, those buildings were not the only new on-campus living. Odom Village offered apartment-style option to families and grad students. According to a statement from Stephanie Barrier, Director of Communications and Marketing, UNC Chapel Hill, the community served as the primary housing for married students until the construction of Beatty Hill in 2005. While the last class of students to stay in Odom was during the 2015-16 academic year, the community housed approximately 500 students, both undergrad and graduates, before its closure, said Barrier. Alan Blattner, executive director of Carolina Housing, described the interior of a typical Odom structure. Upon entering through the front door, residents came to a small corridor. On both sides of the hallway, there were doors to apartment units. Up the stairs, the first floor layout was mimicked. For buildings with two front doors, they included 8 units, a mixture of 1- and 2-bedroom apartments. Blattner said, undergrad apartments were not popular on college campuses till the early 1980s. Then, quote, as off-campus apartments started to spring up in greater number, campuses started to build apartments in greater numbers in order to keep students on campus. They were never really intended to be around for a long, long time, and we certainly got our use out of them. They served a really important piece of Carolina's history. While the quantity of Odom buildings was high, their quality was less so. The buildings were eventually considered not up to code. Specifically, they did not include sprinkler systems required for all residence halls in 2015 by the UNC system. While Blattner said temporary permission was granted to use Odom as housing, even without sprinklers, the university could meet student needs without the property, and they decommissioned it. He said it was not cost-effective to provide utility and building infrastructure to update them, so they were closed to students following 2016. With just over half the buildings gone, university architect and executive director of facilities, planning and design, Evan Yaski, said they have spent almost $3 million on demolition. From this year's state budget, he said they requested $2.5 million to finish the job. According to Yaski, reinvestment in the Odom buildings was not financially justifiable. Quote, often, as will happen in situations where there's more of an urgent need that needs to be addressed quickly, the quality of the buildings wasn't great. I would say that the goal was to put up these buildings quickly and easily, and they were never thought to be buildings that would last for 100 years. However, a few of the Odom buildings have been repurposed. With a landscaped yard greeting visitors, the Carolina Veterans Resource Center stands out from the rest of Odom Village. The center occupies what was the community service and laundry hub for that community. That Yaski pointed out the addition of a lift to reach the second floor of the building. Additionally, contractors for UNC Medical Center's new surgical tower and the Keenan Flagler Business School's additional building use Odom as offices. But 4 years ago, the Board of Trustees considered a different use of the Odom Village acreage. On December 3rd of 2018, the board met to discuss disposition and preservation of the Confederate monument and released the 4-part plan on the subject. This meeting was convened approximately 4 months after that Confederate monument, Silent Sam, was toppled by protesters. The plan suggested the creation of a university history and education center on the Odom Village property, noting the housing's scheduled demolition. And the plan read, this plan requires the construction of a new freestanding single-use building with appropriate buffers and state-of-the-art security measures, as well as the development of excellent exhibits and teaching materials. Estimated capital cost for this proposal was $5.3 million, with an additional $800,000 in yearly operating costs. In response, the Odum Institute for Research in Social Science released an open letter. Quote, Silent Sam proposal an affront to the Odum legacy. The letter, signed on behalf of the Institute's staff, highlights the legacy of Howard Odum, the founder of not only the Institute, but the UNC School of Social Work and Department of Sociology. Odum wrote not only about income and education in the South, according to the letter, but how a legacy of racism and poverty hindered progress in those areas. And it ends with the words, Therefore, we, the staff of Odum Institute, also believe the presence of Silent Sam at a location named for our founder or anywhere on this campus is an affront to Dr. Odom's legacy of working for the rights of all citizens to participate freely and equally in society, free of discrimination, free of prejudice, and free of fear. The four-part plan was met with opposition not only from the Institute, but community members and students as well, taking to Twitter. A protest against re-erecting Silent Sam was scheduled for December 3rd of 2018. Starting their seventh year of vacancy, 22 Odum Village buildings remain, but they are not excluded from the UNC master plan. It's classified under the Campus South Hub, which includes the construction of spaces for research, entrepreneurship, graduate student housing, student services, retail, and recreation, said Barrier. And she said the goal is to create a vibrant area of campus that will attract a broad mix of the community. Among ideas for transforming South Campus is a suggestion to realign a road network, according to Yaski. Quote, it's not anything like the more northern part of campus, which is a little more orthogonal, like a great network of streets. Here, you're sort of walking on one stream and starts curving around, then all of a sudden, you're not sure if you're facing north or east or west. Yaski also mentioned the planned expansion of the utility plant on Manning Drive in order to supply campus with more chilled water. At the end of the day, Yaski said construction takes time, as costs are estimated for projects, which are then weighed against other priorities. And he said some of that is just part and parcel of the way the university works. It's not like good or bad, it just is that way. There's often way more ideas and goals than people have, than there's time and money to achieve those things. Well, rarely do we include in our music articles in the Indie Week anything much classical, but here's one featuring my old employer, the North Carolina Symphony, and its new music director, Carlos Miguel Prieto. And it was written this week by Jasmine Gallup. A riotous celebration of Latin American music filled May Mandy Concert Hall late last month as renowned conductor Carlos Miguel Prieto took the stage to open the North Carolina Symphony's new season. Prieto, who was hired as the symphony's new music director in February, kicked off his first full season with the orchestra in style. The classical concert was not a subdued, somber event. Instead, it was a party, with Prieto leading talented international soloist Pacho Flores first through Haydn's trumpet concerto in E-flat major, followed by a contemporary Paquito de Rivera piece commissioned specially for that trumpet player. Flores, undoubtedly the star of the show, was later joined by Hector Molina on the cuatro, a small four-string guitar originating in Latin America. Just before intermission, the two left the stage to huge applause, only to return minutes later for an exceptional encore, Cantos y Revueltos, composed by Flores with Molina and the orchestra's string section. It was a playful set as the duo improvised the musical riffs and engaged the audience in a call and response. September's opening weekend gave audiences a good idea of what Prieto, who replaced former music director Grant Llewellyn, hoped to achieve during his tenure. The new conductor has a history of mixing styles, drawing audiences in with classical favorites like Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 4, which was played during the second half of the concert, then hitting them with something new, like New Orleans swing. Pietro says, I love conducting what people love hearing, but I wouldn't be myself if I just had a season with only the things that orchestras play over and over again. I'm not someone who believes in putting together a season, though I know what the audience already likes. Putting together a season through what I know the audience already likes, I don't think that's challenging enough. I like to challenge the orchestra. I like to challenge the audience and expand everyone's horizons. Pietro, originally from Mexico, is the orchestra's sixth music director since its inception in 1932. He served as a guest conductor for the symphony since 2011, occasionally stepping in to direct concerts featuring the music of Anna Klein, Gabriela Ortiz, and others. Before coming to North Carolina, he served as the director of the Orquestra Sinfónico Nacional de México and the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra, also conducting concerts across the globe. The North Carolina Symphony needs to maintain a strong connection to classical repertoire, but it should also work to expand that repertoire, Pietro says, and, quote, not because of any kind of external pressure, but because the music is good. If the orchestra goes in a certain direction, it should always be a direction that's driven by excellence and quality. But that doesn't mean they can't explore new music or find different ways to connect with a more diverse audience. He adds, world-class music can and should include music from around the world. The North Carolina Symphony is already heavily involved in the community through music education programs, but Pietro says he wants to build an even stronger rapport with people across the triangle. The world of classical music has an unfortunate stigma of elitism, Pietro says, but speaks to and can be accessible to a large number of people. Quote, North Carolina, and specifically Raleigh, has a growing Latin community, growing in size, importance, and relevance. I really think that my presence there will allow for some nice connections to happen. In addition to building a more diverse audience, Pietro wants to grow the symphony's overall place in the community, he says. When it comes to the things that draw people to North Carolina, he would like for the orchestra to be mentioned alongside the universities, hospitals, and sports teams. His enthusiasm and passion for music is almost palpable as he talks about the orchestra's upcoming season. Asked whether there are any shows he's particularly excited about, he responds, every single one. Attending only select classical shows is like visiting a museum and only going to see the paintings you already love, Pietro says. And he encourages audience to not just visit the famous paintings everyone's crowding around, but explore new rooms in the hopes they'll find something that speaks to them. And he says, I beg the audience not prioritize one series over the other or one composer over the other. Truly, the orchestra is there for the community. The 2 minutes or 3 minutes remaining to me, I'll just outline a few of the other music-related articles. First, Vivian Leva and Riley Calcagno are both raised by parents immersed in old-time and bluegrass. Both mastered multiple acoustic instruments as children and started performing in their teens and sent summers riding to the Fiddler's Convention and competition circuit. But funny thing happens with aging. Growing older is all relative for Leva and Calcagno, both just 25 years old, yet hard-earned wisdom abounds on their new album, which is called Imaginary People, and it came out on September 15th on Free Dirt Record. It marks their first release under the Viv and Riley moniker, their first collaboration with producer Alex Bingham, and their first time intentionally breaking free from acoustic roots. The duo wrote songs on electric guitar and drum set, no big deal for most, but borderline sacrilegious for those who came up in reverential old-time scenes. It sounds trivial, Calcagno tells Indy over lunch, but using an electric guitar and drum set really changed the possibilities and spurred a more adventurous spirit going into our first recording session with Al. And there's part of a much longer article about this, the duo, and about the recording, which is out, which came out on September 15th. Again, Imaginary People is the title. I will summarize Keisha Jennings' article about North Carolina hip-hop and releases by Madrik, Durham High, and Pat Jr. And my time is quite limited, and I'll just urge you to check out the Indie Week and read that article if you're interested in the hip-hop genre. And she says, it's no secret I believe in North Carolina's rap scene. I hope to convince whoever's reading this to believe in it, too. Talent has always been high here, and the range of sounds expansive. One of the most impressive things about North Carolina artists is the way they package their music. Creative marketing abilities are truly impressive. They leverage social media to engage audiences and attract new listeners. Experiencing simultaneous excitement for three distinct projects has been incredibly refreshing, especially considering the path mainstream hip-hop has taken recently. I've eagerly shared these projects with anyone willing to listen. You should check them out, too. And here they are. Madrik, The Bike Ride, Tape 2. Madrik's new project can be best described as a case study in the art of sampling and storytelling. Through poetic narratives and mellow cadence, listeners, in particular those experiencing the highs and lows of dating, are able to profoundly connect with the North Raleigh artists and realize they are not alone in navigating the complex ebbs and flows of love. And a collaboration between G. Yamazawa and Rec N Crew is like a gift from the rap gods. In case it wasn't clear before, the three Durhamites, George Yamazawa, Matrice Goodwin, and Brandon Sutton, are now officially Durham High. They didn't attend high school together, but the group are an ode to all things Durham. The Durham High is kind of like a metaphor for showing Durham on a higher echelon level. We're showing Durham art at its highest form, said Tree Carter. And finally, Pat Jr. stands out as one of the North Carolina's most consistent artists. His track record reflects a commitment to excellence in every aspect, high-quality raps, innovative visual storytelling. And have you seen the gold tapes on Grill Talk Mixtape Volume 1? The artist continues to deliver scorching rap verses that fans crave, but his ability to offer an alternative sonic experience with each project. And that brings me to a close for Indie Week, John Federson. It's available as a podcast at ncreadingservice.org. Thanks for listening, everybody, and farewell.